Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the 2009 Alaska WAMI Mini Medical School Series at Providence Hospital. WAMI is a collaborative medical school representing universities in Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. During the month of October, Alaska WAMI hosted a public lecture series at Providence Hospital. This week, we bring you Dr. Jeff DeMain, founder and director of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska, and clinical associate professor of pediatrics for the University of Washington School of Medicine. His talk on climate change and the impact on human health in Alaska perspective was recorded on Tuesday, October 20th.
Well, it's great to be here, and this is certainly a topic that's very close to my heart. I've been working with issues regarding climate change for probably about 2 years. My focus has been the impact on human health, which is what I'd like to address today during tonight's talk. And, you know, as I do speaking, and from a medical standpoint, we always give you our disclosures, and I think it's important that you know that. The first disclosure that I want to give you is I am not a global warming or a climatologist. I'm not a scientist studying, you know, the impact of global warming on the planet or why this is occurring. I can speak to it a little bit, but probably most of the audience knows more about that than I do. The purpose of my discussion is not to determine the causes nor to determine the solutions, but to really address observations. And I'll let you walk away with some of your own conclusions. So I'm going to hopefully give you some adequate evidence to realize that the warming of our environment is having an impact, and it's not only impacting us, but it's impacting other aspects of our society. I do research for 3 different pharmaceutical companies, none of which have anything to do with venoms or climate change. I do speak for a handful of companies. I'm an editorial reviewer for 3 medical journals, and unfortunately, I have no financial conflicts to report. So let's just start talking about climate change and what is climate change. First of all, climate change, you know, when you look at the scientific consensus, there's really no – the consensus is that the planet is warming. It is. It's warming, and you can't argue that it's not warming. Now, is it a natural cycle? It certainly appears that, at least in part, it is. So where the big debates occur is why it's warming, and is this a natural phenomenon, or is it being impacted by human or what we call anthropogenic causes? But it is warming, and as a result of that warming, we're seeing changes in ecosystems. And when we look at the warming, the reason it's occurring is what we call greenhouse gases. Now, greenhouse gases include things like carbon dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, methane gas, and actually water vapor is a very significant greenhouse gas and probably contributing as much or more to what we're seeing on the planet currently as any other. So the greenhouse gases essentially get trapped, and that causes solar energy that normally would be reflected back. It causes the solar energy to really kind of stay low to the surface of the Earth, and therefore we get warming. So this is about the extent of what I know about global warming. So I'm going to kind of show you this cartoon. So the sun's rays are reflected down onto the Earth. Now, if you have thick white ice, a lot of that solar rays are going back up into space, so we lose that heat. It's dissipated out. If you have a lot of asphalt and you have a lot of blue water, well, a lot of that heat is absorbed, so it's not reflected back. So that's one issue. The other issue is when you're dealing with these greenhouse gases, when the heat is reflected back or these rays are reflected back, it strikes water particles or carbon particles or methane particles, and it's actually bounced around. So instead of being dissipated out, more of it is staying within our atmosphere. So that's the very simplistic answer is what is global warming? That's basically what it is. And there are scientists that spend their entire life studying this. So I don't in any way mean to insult them, but I don't. At the same time, I certainly don't want to pretend that I'm one of them. So what we want to look at is what are we seeing? So since 1950, the planet has risen 0.74 degrees Celsius. Well, 0.74 degrees Celsius is probably approaching about not quite 2 degrees Fahrenheit, but about maybe 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Nighttime and winter variance is higher than that. It's at least 1 degree Celsius. Temperatures are rising faster in the polar regions. We've had at least a 2 degree Celsius rise on average. Actually, in Alaska, I did studies, and I'm going to talk about some of my work, and we're going to see that it's about a 3.4 degree Fahrenheit rise in Alaska over the last 50 years, and about a 6.4 degree Fahrenheit rise in winter minimal temperatures, which actually play a very significant role as well. The projected temperatures for 2100 is anywhere from 1.4 to another 5.8, and actually the IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, recently raised that to 6.4 degrees Celsius of what their projection is. So that's really pretty high. When we look back in the history of our planet, there probably hasn't been a time that that's been measured where it's been more than a 0.5 degrees Celsius rise. So we're already into historic territory. And we do feel that higher latitudes and higher elevations are going to be affected more so than lower elevations. Or lower latitudes. So this is a cartoon that I like because it really does depict the fact that we go through cycles. I mean, we're literally coming out of what's called the Little Ice Age. I mean, so that's reality. And we're not living amongst dinosaurs. So things change. So the planet does go through this variability. But when you look at these variable phases, we're really going up and down about 0.5 degrees Celsius. Seems to be about the fluctuation that we see. And around 1200, this is a warming period. Actually, in Britain, this is when the crops failed and there was drought. And this is probably when we saw the migration of the Vikings to Greenland. But then we had a glaciation period where actually the Thames River froze and was glaciated. So again, we're coming out of that period. But what's been happening is that our rise is really unprecedented on the planet right now. Not only the level that we've had rise, which is just barely over 0.5, but the rate that we're seeing this climb, because most of this rise has occurred over the last 50 years, which is really a very short period of time when you're looking at history. So the World Health Organization, certainly we have great respect for the World Health Organization, a lot of very smart people, have actually stated that over the past 30 years, they estimate that 150,000 deaths have occurred as a direct result of climate change throughout the world. Now, part of that's due to flooding, bad weather, maybe malaria and dengue fever, which is certainly on the rise. But what we're seeing in many countries is they're losing their shoreline. They're becoming flooded. They estimate about 5 million disability-adjusted life years. Now, this can be people displaced from home or injured or so forth. And this is associated with extreme heat, drought, storms, floods, changes in air and water quality, malnutrition from crop failures, transmission of infectious disease, and changes in insect patterns. So when we look, this is a very nice slide. I actually borrowed it from a Dr. Patz. And what this is looking at is the health effects on climate change. And this is, I think, really catalogs it very neatly. But when you look at some of these impacts, we can see what's already happening in Alaska. Well, we're seeing, you know, issues regarding aeroallergens, which is like pollens and molds, as well as air pollution. And this affects respiratory disease such as emphysema, chronic bronchitis, and asthma, and allergies. Insect-related diseases, well, I'm going to be speaking about that tonight. We're seeing anaphylaxis, which is severe reactions requiring medical care, and now we've seen our first two reported deaths. We're looking and following very closely vector-borne diseases such as West Nile virus, and there's also concerns about Ixodes ticks. So these are being, there's surveillance looking for that. We don't have that yet, but that is a concern in Alaska. Waterborne diseases. We had our first outbreak of Vibrio parahemolyticus, and I'm going to talk about that later. We're seeing contamination of water supplies, contamination of food supplies due to flooding and due to failure of our ice cellars, particularly in the villages that rely on subsistence. And mental health and environmental refugees, a very big issue as well. We're having significant impact on culture. We're losing a lot of archaeologic regions throughout our state. Graveyards are being eroded into the sea, and we just can't keep up with it. We're seeing forced migration or moving of villages. So this is impacting people's lives right to the very core. Not to mention the fact that we're having, there's challenges now with the subsistence way of life. life, and that's altering cultures as well. So this is a very serious issue. So now let's talk about what's going on in Alaska. This, I think, was pretty neat. I think the message here is the for those that can't see it on the radio, this is a cartoon that says, oh, relax, he doesn't bite. Well, he's got a skunk on a leash, and this is, I'll give credit, Chad Carpenter, and I'm using this with his permission. The point I wanted to make here is you need to ask the right question, and you need to be concerned about the right problem. Sometimes what seems very obvious is not the main issue. So in the news, this is something in Alaska. We pick up the newspaper, and I'll almost guarantee that 2 or 3 days out of the week, there's going to be a front page article regarding climate change. I know I follow them, and I've got files of them and I use several. So this is one that's talking about the polar meltdown. And the point here is the scientists sound the alarm that it's picking up speed. You know, right now we are today where we thought we were going to be in 30 years. So things are changing a little faster than what we had anticipated. And the circumpolar regions will definitely be the first to illustrate the impacts of climate change. Now, what's the circumpolar region? I'm not talking about just Alaska. This is talking about Canada, Europe. So think about from the Arctic Circle north. Those are areas that are going to have the greatest risk and the greatest impact because you're going to see the greatest degree of change. So over the next 100 years, for example, in Alaska, it's been predicted that Alaska will lose 90% of its historic tundra, that we're going to see forestation in those areas because of changes in the ecosystem. Now, I don't think that we're going to have birch trees growing north of Fairbanks. Well, that's just not true. I guess we will probably see. There's a lot of birch trees in Fairbanks, but as we go further into the Arctic, but we'll probably see a lot of scrub alder, and we'll probably see a lot of willow, and we're going to see a lot of other trees as opposed to just pure tundra. With that, we're going to see resulting dramatic change in the ecosystem, and it's going to impact plant and animal species, including us. The increase of insects and pathogens may result in epidemics of plant disease as well as insect attacks, and we've seen both of those. So when we're looking at the temperature changes in global warming, what I'm looking at are temperatures in Fairbanks, because we will be talking about some research that we did in Fairbanks, and what's happening in Alaska. And I think an important point here is temperature, like weather, is chaotic. There's variability. It bounces up and down, but what you do is you follow trends. So, you know, you can't look at the year 2004 to 2005 and determine based on what happened in that 1 year span as what's going to happen over the next 50 years. You need to look at time frames, at least in decades, and even beyond that. So I think that's very important. So when you see headlines, you know, where the glaciers are growing, well, it's because they might have had an advance that year, or, you know, that might have been a retreat in sea ice that year. You can't base it on 1 year's variability. You have to look at trends. So over the past 50 years, Alaska's climate has warmed about 3.4 degrees, or about 2 degrees Celsius. The winter temperatures in Alaska have risen 6.4 degrees on average, or about 4 degrees Celsius. The planet at the same time has risen 0.74 degrees Celsius, and it's projected to rise at least 0.2 degrees Celsius every decade from this point forward. And it's felt that there actually may be an acceleration because the more ice we lose, the more absorption of heat we're going to have. And Alaska is, the temperatures are rising at 3 to 4 times the rate of the global average. So let's first talk about permafrost. And you say, well, how does that affect health? Well, think about villages and homes that are built principally on permafrost that's not permafrost anymore. So what we're seeing is thawing of permafrost. You have homes that are collapsing into the land. You know, you've got villages that are literally up on stilts with boardwalks to get around. Where the ice roads that are so critical for supplies in Alaska, including up on the North Slope, they used to have 110-day use. You could utilize an ice road 110 days. Now you can utilize an ice road about 90 days because the ice is melting, because the permafrost is melting. Now with that, what are the problems? The observed change is that the warming soil and temperature is thawing and damaging traditional food cellars. So in native villages, they don't have refrigerators and freezers oftentimes. They'll use underground food cellars, and they require the permafrost to keep those foods cold. The health concern is that with the reduced subsistence food supply and increased foodborne illness, and that's because of food spoilage. Alaska right now has the highest highest incidence of botulism in the country, and we're as concerned that this is even going to get worse. Projected change is 20 to 50% increase in active thaw over time. Potential adaptation is baseline permafrost mapping, getting a better understanding of it, monitoring, and really coming up with alternate sources of food storage. This is one of the, this is the food storage cellars or the ice cellars that are traditional in many of the native villages. And you can get a feeling the permafrost is melting and these ice cellars are collapsing. So what about erosion? This is a big issue, a huge issue. We have erosion throughout the coastal regions, the west coast region of Alaska, and that's because sea ice has melted. And with the sea ice melting, you've got a much greater wave action. In addition to that, the sea ice is, and water is slamming into the shores. So we're losing a significant amount of land, maybe 150 meters every year. And like I said, what we're seeing is we're seeing loss of very important archaeological regions and history. We're seeing graveyards that are falling into the sea. You now have 12 villages that are absolutely in peril. They're either working to try to preserve seawalls, or we're in situations where those villages are planning to move, so they're going to relocate to higher ground. And just to let you know a little closer, these villages are primarily going to be coastal. We see them along, for example, the Chukchi Sea. Kivalina is definitely one that is impacted. So with erosion, we're seeing the observed change is delayed shore ice, thawing permafrost, and storm activity that results in rapid erosion. Health concerns include damage to critical infrastructure, including airports, including roads, including ice cellars, and there's also injury. So with this, we're seeing a greater risk of injury among the people in those areas. We have projected future change in that there's increased rate of shore and riverbank erosion, and then there's also concerns about the ability to navigate the rivers. So what can we do for adaptation is shore and river monitoring, erosion mitigation measures, as well as injury prevention. So this is looking at the rising sea level. Now, the rising sea level is occurring as well. Like I said, I think most of the damage to the shores are not so much the sea level going up at this point, but mainly because of the lack of sea ice. But rising temperatures are causing the sea to rise. And the greatest impact, again, is going to be a result of the waves and a result of the impact on the shoreline. The IPCC, or Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change, which is kind of the international body of scientists that are really making a lot of these observations as well as predictions, have feel that there's been at least a 10 to 20 centimeter rise in sea level throughout the world over the last century. It predicts that this rise will be another 9 to 88 centimeters by 2100. And why, you said, that's a big range. Why is it? Well, there's a lot of different predictors out there, and there are networks that are computer networks that make these predictions. And really smart people and scientists put in all these different variables. And based on those variables and based on patterns of change, these computers, along with the help of satellites, try to help predict what this change will ultimately be. So someone's not just throwing a number in the air. It's being done principally by computers. And so there's computers programs that are much more conservative. Some are much more aggressive. And that's why you see such a range. So this is Shishmaref. And you can see Shishmaref is literally, you know, falling into the sea. And then in 2009, so it was just in Copenhagen in 2009, the IPCC upgraded their potential sea level rise to 100 centimeters or a full meter. And just as a general rule, if you raise the sea a meter, it doesn't seem like much. Multiply that by 150 as far as how much shoreline that really is. That's a lot of shoreline. So you're talking about almost the length of two football fields that potentially will be underwater in 100 years. So is that a prediction? It may not happen at all. But that's certainly a concern. And, you know, again, well-educated people with very complex systems are trying to make the best prediction they can. They may be completely off. There may be no rise. There may be none. But based on what they've been seeing over the past 50 years, it certainly appears that that is a concern. I took an image out of this. Was just a couple of days ago in the Anchorage Daily News. Maldives takes a dive for climate change. So this is actually the Maldives. It's a country that's 20 islands in the Indian Ocean. And this is the cabinet, and this is signing this bill is the Minister of Fisheries and Agriculture. So they're wearing snorkel or scuba gear, and they're signing this letter underwater. And this is being sent to the UN in anticipation of the 2010 Copenhagen IPCC meeting, and basically calling on all countries to reduce their CO2 emissions. Maldives, by the way, has a sea level. They're 7 feet above sea level. So they're one of the lowest countries in the world. So there's concern that this country will, you know, in not too much time, may not be land anymore. It may be all underwater. What about receding glaciers? Well, I live in Girdwood, and Portage Valley is one of my favorite places. So I'm there an awful lot, and it's, you know, absolutely beautiful there. But when you look at Portage Valley, and I don't have the history in Alaska that these photos show, but in 1914, this is a NOAA photo. It showed that Portage Glacier was all the way up to where the parking lot is right now. And as everyone knows in this room that's been to Portage, you can't even see the glacier from the parking lot any longer. So what's happened is retreated 5 kilometers since 1939, and it's retreating at a rate of about 150 meters every year. Now, there are some glaciers that are exceeding or advancing, is how it's termed, but most glaciers are retreating throughout the world. But these are dynamic. So there, some are advancing, some are retreating. There's also an impact on forests. Again, we look at the Kenai Peninsula. This is something we're all familiar with. But what we've seen is the devastation from the spruce bark beetle. Scientists have now determined that the spruce bark beetle and the damage to the 4.4 million acres of spruce trees is indeed impacted by climate change, that they feel that has weakened the forest. And, you know, I know there's issues regarding maturity, and I'm sure there's other variables. But again, scientists in this area have concluded that this is an impact of climate change. We're seeing something very similar going on right now through in the lower 48. There's a pine bark beetle that's doing something similar. We're also losing conifer trees throughout Colorado, also related to warming. What's happening is tree roots, instead of snow falling and staying on the ground, the snow is melting. And now you've got exposed roots. Then you have freezing. And, you know, so you're going through this kind of freeze-thaw cycle, and the roots aren't able to tolerate it, and it's weakening the trees. At least that's one of the theories. Now, what about impact on mammals? Well, you know, we'll talk about the caribou herds. The caribou herds are definitely decreasing. This is a photograph of the porcupine herd. Well, there's some issues that are affecting the caribou herds. The caribou go to their feeding grounds every year at the same time, year after year after year. Well, what's happening now, they're arriving in their feeding grounds, and rather than finding these nice little sapling stalks that are nice and gentle and tender, they're getting there and it's woody plants, because you're seeing these plants that are growing 3 weeks earlier than they used to. And when they also arrive there, they're finding a lot more bugs, a lot more insects, and caribou have to move at about 6 miles an hour just to be, you know, so they won't be just swarmed and bitten by insects. So this is having a significant impact on calving, is having an impact on the survival of calves, and again, it's impacting their ability to survive. So they're going to have to adapt if they're going to survive. Well, I don't need to say very much about the polar bear. I think this is a kind of a hot-button political issue, but the honest truth is the polar bear relies on sea ice for hunting sea mammals. And with the regression of sea ice, there's areas where there's sea ice hundreds of miles offshore where there used to be sea ice right at shore, the polar bear is certainly having a struggle surviving. So again, this is another issue. So looking at the decline of sea ice, we're seeing significant decreases over just a short period of time. But this is a kind of a lesson I wanted you to learn for a second. This is showing the overall decline of sea ice. Beginning in 1978, we see a decline that's really quite significant. It's a decline from 7.5 million square kilometers to an area of 4.2 million square kilometers. So that's about a 35 or 40% decline. And then this was pointed out. You look at this number from 2006 to 2007, my goodness, look at that decline. So it's almost like, goodness, you know, this is terrible. Is this going to set up a trend? Well, just like you can't take that 1 year from 2006 to 2007, you can't take the next year from 2007 to 2009 because you're seeing a reversal of that. So the point is, you can't make assumptions based on 1 or 2 years of data. You have to make it based on a large body of data in order to establish trends. So what I'm showing is that even though there was a significant drop from 06 to 05, or I'm sorry, 06 to 07, there was a significant rise from 07 to 09. So what it did, it went back up to the trend baseline, but we're still having that decline. That hasn't changed. So what's estimated right now is that there's a decline of sea ice of about 11.2% per decade. So that's what is, that is now the reported decline, and that was based on the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado, and that's 2009 data. So the impact of declining sea ice has been forming later in the fall and departing earlier in the spring. What we're seeing is when we do have an advance of sea ice, this is one-year ice. One-year ice means it's thin. It can't support the weight of whales. It can't support the weight of sea mammals. It can't support the weight even of humans. So we're seeing hunters that are subsistence hunting are now falling into the water because the sea ice is not holding them. So one-year sea ice is not very sturdy, not very stable as compared to the multi-sea ice. So that's a big issue. We're seeing shorter seasons for ice over transport. Remember, I mentioned that regarding the transport from trucks and so forth. We're seeing disruption in the mammal harvest, which is critical to subsistence way of life. And we're seeing increased vulnerability to coastal erosion, as I mentioned earlier. I wanted to make a point here. I want to mention Mike Brubaker. I worked with him on the governor's subcabinet for climate change adaptation advisory group. He was a very, very good colleague there. I enjoyed working with him, and he's done some work for the Native Tribal Center, and I think he's done some great work, and I've actually referenced some of his work in here. So I wanted to make a special point that he's done some really interesting, reported some interesting data. Let's talk about air quality, smoke, and other respiratory irritants. I mean, that's certainly something that impacts health. So with current impacts, we see problems with airborne allergens. That's things like pollens and molds in the air. Well, may I ask a question? How many people in this room have allergies or asthma? That's pretty impressive. That's probably 30 to 40%. So if you increase the molds and you increase the pollens, are things going to get worse? The answer is yes. So that's a big concern, and it's not just here in Alaska. This is happening all over the world, and I'll report that here in a bit. We're seeing increases in forest fires and tundra fires, and that's because we have melting permafrost, you have drier conditions, and so as a result of the many lightning strikes we have every year, we're seeing not only more fires, but the fires are having a greater reach. So in the recent years, we had 11 acres burned just between 2004-2005. That represented the first and third largest year we have seen in Alaska. There's record-breaking tundra fires throughout Alaska. Certainly in 2007, we saw that. So we're seeing increasing expansion of the number of acres that are being destroyed by fire, which is resulting in smoke, pollutants, and increasing respiratory disease. Fairbanks, for example, throughout the summer oftentimes exceeds the EPA air quality for respiratory disease. And in addition to particulate matter from the smoke, there's also release of other chemicals such as mercury, which is at high levels as well. So some of our future issues that we're concerned with is increased amounts of smoke and respiratory disease, greater release of mercury, and other pollutants. So what are some other pollutants? Well, when you actually have retreating glaciers, you've got more glacier silt, and there's a lot of interest in that resulting in respiratory disease. That's actually never been studied, believe it or not. I'd love to do it, though. And we're seeing continued increase in airborne allergens. So I'm going to talk about a few studies here. This was a really beautiful study. The lead author was a Dr. Shia, and another author was Dr. Wayne in two studies. But honestly, the anchor for this is a friend of mine, Paul Epstein at Harvard. He is great, has probably done some of the best research and some of the best work in health-related issues and climate change. So if you wanted to actually look up a reference, and he's referenced in my paper if you picked it up, Paul Epstein, he's really has done some great work. But in this particular study, they wanted to see is there a correlation between climate and pollen distribution. Well, this is a very interesting model. What they did is looked at, they took levels, and they had three different levels of greenhouses, and the only change in the greenhouse was the CO2 levels. The temperatures were the same, amount of sunlight was the same, water, food, they all got Miracle-Gro or whatever they've got, but everything was the same. The only thing that was different and regulated was the CO2 levels. And what they were able to demonstrate is with ragweed, if you doubled the CO2 levels, and they doubled it from 350, which is where we are, roughly where we are today, to 700. You have an increase in pollen production of 61%, increased shoot biomass, so the plant has increased biomass of 63%, increased plant height of 9%, increased seed mass of 31%, although it did not change the pollen grains. I didn't mention it here, but they also demonstrated that it made the pollen more allergenic, so it was a more reactive as far as an immune sensitivity. Now, that was looking at tree pollens. That's also a big issue here. What I've done here is looked at three international studies, one from Poland, one from Denmark, and one from Spain. And when you look at these different studies, all of them show that there's an increase in birch pollen concentration with air temperature. This one shows earlier season start and earlier peak, an increased level of birch pollen associated with increased winter temperature, which is a big factor here, as well as increased spring temperature. In Spain, projectors of pollen concentration include temperature and sunlight hours. So in summary, preseason temperature and precipitation are important predictors or projectors of tree pollen production. Now, I can tell you last year at the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and that was in Washington, D.C., there was at least a dozen or two dozen papers demonstrating this from around the world. This year, I was fortunate enough to be invited to be one of the reviewers for the abstract submitted, and I must have read myself a dozen papers that are showing this from around the world. So this is happening everywhere. Is it happening in Alaska? Anecdotally, I can tell you it is. The first pollen counting that occurred, at least in Anchorage, was in 1995 when I arrived in Anchorage. And I can tell you that our season is longer, starting earlier, and we have higher levels of pollen. Now, again, just like those graphs, we have years that are up or down. This past summer, it was pretty intense. Now, this is a beautiful study. This is Dr. Ziska, and he's the one that actually came up with this original chamber model. And what he looked at, he did the same thing. In fact, it was his design that Dr. Epstein used. But he had three chambers, and he's growing plants. And what he's doing, he's taking pre-industrial levels of CO2, which the levels were 280. He's using current levels of CO2, 370, and the projected CO2 level for 2100 of 600. And what he found is that when you compared the pollen production from pre-industrial to current levels, there was a 132% increase. When you compare the current levels to what they project in 2100, there's a 90% further increase. So CO2 seems to drive pollen. Now, does anyone have an idea why that would happen? Yes, ma'am. Well, that is. But I think the reason for that is when CO2 is rising, that kind of is the point of the spear, so to speak. And we have heat and other factors that are rising with it. So when you have rising CO2, it would make sense to have more plants so it could absorb the CO2. So it's almost like a planet healing thyself type of scenario. So it's kind of exciting when you see that, really, you know, to watch this kind of healing phenomena, really. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and that's just Jeff DeMaine's off-the-cuff thought. Now, Dr. Zistra did another study, and I think this really drives it home. So taking it out of the laboratory setting and putting it into real world. In Maryland, he had 12 sites in the city, around the city, and I believe it was Baltimore. And then he had 12 sites in rural areas around Baltimore. And what he did is he looked at 2000 and 2001. In 2000, CO2 levels were 30% higher in the urban area. Temperature was 1.8 degrees Celsius higher in the urban area compared to the rural. In 2100, about the same thing, CO2 31% higher urban, and temperatures 2 degrees Celsius higher in the urban area. So what did he find? What he found in a real live world situation is ragweed grew faster and flowered earlier and produced significantly greater biomass and pollen in the urban areas compared to the rural areas. That's real world. That is not in a greenhouse laboratory. So again, I talked a little bit about, you know, what's going on in Alaska and how do we predict these models? What's going to happen in 2100? I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know anyone that does. But this is a program, a very brilliant researcher. This is Scott Rupp from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Very, very good. He's running a program called Scenario Network Alaska Program, or SNAP. So it's one of these models, it's recognized worldwide as a very important model. Using satellites and inputting all these variables, they're predicting everything from permafrost to glacier retreat to CO2 levels to everything. Well, one of the areas that he's looking at was actually very interesting to me was trees. That's pretty interesting, right? So what he showed, the green line here represents conifer. That's like spruce and hemlock. The brown line represents deciduous. That's like your cottonwood and your birch. Well, what he's showing is that when these are measuring pixels, so you're looking at 200,000 pixels, and this is in a kilometer squared. I don't know if that's quite 200,000 trees, but we can call it that if you wish. And what he's showing is this has been the actual measurements through the 19th, actually from the 18th century to current. Now, what happens is there's a drop in those conifer trees that has occurred already, and that was in the mid-1990s. At the same time, the deciduous trees, which is about 150,000 pixels, at the same time, there was a rise around the mid-1990s. So what's happening is that at the 2010 mark, we're seeing there's more deciduous trees now, up to the 25,000 pixels per kilometer, and the conifers are down to 100,000 pixels per kilometer squared. So what does that mean? Well, when people, from a respiratory standpoint, conifer trees are not significant allergens. It's really heavy pollen. It just drops on the ground. It stains your windshield on your car. Whereas it's the deciduous trees, the cottonwood and the birch and the alder and the willow, those are the types of pollens that are going to be airborne. They're very small. They're the ones we're inhaling. We're getting them in our eyes and nose, and it's causing more respiratory disease. So what we're seeing is that, you know, whether it's because of fire or whether it's because of change in ecosystems, we're seeing a shift away from conifer trees and a shift toward deciduous trees, and that's already occurring. Now, what about other air pollution? This is a photo of Dave Henry and his 185. I was taking pictures of fireweed. You know, I do a lot of talks, so, you know, I want to take some nice pictures. And when I went back and got them developed, all of them were foggy like this. And I couldn't really understand it. But what it was is this was smoke in the air. And, you know, we get so used to it, we just get used to it. I didn't even really recognize it when I was in his plane. So this was Fairbanks, by the way, in 2004. And this is the following year, the exact same location. I think he got a new truck. Other than that, it's the very same place. So you can see the difference. But when you're in the midst of that, you kind of adjust to it, and I don't think it's as easily recognized. So what happened in 2004, this is called the Boundary Fire, and it was about 540,000 acres that burned. And you can look at EPA air quality index levels and see that when you're getting into red and purple, this is highly dangerous levels, whether you have respiratory disease or not. We start having problems for respiratory disease when you're in moderate, which is yellow. We were in the hazardous zone for everyone. So these levels can get quite high. And by the way, the YK Delta in Alaska has the highest pollution level of the entire state. And the reason for that is the forest fires that we're seeing. And it's not just a matter of smoke. These are particulates that are in the air that also contain heavy metals such as mercury. But this is a very significant issue. Now, we look at other cities. Now, this is a city of Atlanta, and I'm kind of comparing it juxtaposed to the city of Anchorage. Now, I don't want to pretend that we suffer with the same level of pollution that Atlanta does, but we do have issues with pollution, mainly from car exhaust, and we get these low pressures, and we get these inversions, and you wind up with, you know, you can actually taste it sometimes, and certainly it can burn your eyes. So we're seeing air pollution in cities. We're seeing heat waves in cities, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. More exacerbations of chronic disease. The rate of asthma is double in the urban areas compared to rural areas. Extreme precipitation events and waterborne disease are occurring now. There was terrible situations in Chicago. And then increased pollen. Like I said, you know, with higher CO2, higher heat, more ragweed pollen. So we look at urban heat. This is a very interesting thermal satellite image. And what it's showing in the city of Phoenix, you can look at the urban area. They're showing a temperature in the city of 92 degrees. If you go out to the suburbs, that temperature drops to about, 88 degrees. If you go out to the rural area, and this is in the immediate area, it drops to 85. This is called a heat island effect. So again, remember I told you earlier, in urban areas, you have a 30% higher level of CO2 than you do rural areas. So again, the heat is being driven by the CO2. Let's look at other impacts on human health in Alaska. So now we're getting into my kind of world. This is now bugs. So this is really good for me. So we'll talk about insect-borne disease. Even though in Alaska, we don't really have a lot of insect-borne disease, there's concern about it. But we are seeing significant increases in malaria and dengue fever throughout the world. What's been very interesting is the mosquitoes that carry the dengue fever and malaria were limited to about 1,000 meters. And that was because of the ecosystem, the inhabitation, the flora, the fauna, the temperatures, everything. Well, with the change, now the mosquito is up to about 2,000 meters. Guess where the villages were built? At about 1,500 meters. So now we're seeing villages that they're having a significantly higher exposure rate to things like malaria and dengue fever, which is huge. Now, the good news there is we are very close to a cure for malaria, or at least a vaccine for malaria. It probably will be released in the next 18 months, I think. Isn't that right, Tom, from GSK? Actually, that was research funded by the Gates Foundation. But nonetheless, this is a big issue. So all the more important to have those vaccines. Also, we're seeing waterborne and food disease throughout Alaska, which we'll talk about now. This is Joe McLaughlin, a friend of mine. He's a state epidemiologist. And what he did is he published a very nice paper in New England Journal in 2005. And what this was regarding was the first Vibrio parahemolyticus. This is paralytic shellfish poisoning. And this is caused by a toxin, a bacteria and a toxin called it's called Vibrio parahemolyticus. But what happens, you don't see Vibrio parahemolyticus until water gets above 59 degrees. Or about 15 degrees Celsius. Well, what happened is the water around the Cordova area actually started to rise. And this is looking at the temperature. So this is the temperature. So as the temperature rose above that 59 degree Fahrenheit, look what happened. You started seeing, pow, you started seeing these cases of Vibrio because the Vibrio could proliferate. Why? Because the copepods and algae can grow in the warmer water, and that's what's necessary for the Vibrio. So we've now actually, there's been some reported cases, I believe this is either last year or this year, in Bristol Bay as well. So this is something that certainly was well reported in New England Journal, in Prince William Sound, and it's something that we're probably going to see more problems with. Other things in Alaska, and I think I mentioned this earlier, is the stinging caterpillars. I got pretty excited about this. What we were seeing or reported in the newspaper is berry pickers were having problems with this really itchy, burning rash when they were out picking berries. And then it was identified, a photo was taken. This is by the Anchorage Daily News, my main source of information. Well, I'm just kidding. But there was a photo of this caterpillar that they found on the plant. Well, that caterpillar is actually called a tussock moth. A tussock moth is a venomous caterpillar that's primarily seen in Oregon and Washington State. In fact, where its claim to fame is when loggers were cutting down trees there, and these infested trees, all these stinging setae or spines of the caterpillar were being inhaled into the lung and in the eyes of the loggers. And there was a lot of individuals that developed severe allergic reactions and ultimately anaphylaxis to this. That was demonstrated by Dr. Marshall and Saxon. So all these little fuzzy hairs are actually venomous spines. And so that's why when the berry pickers rubbed it against their arm, they were getting these rashes. And it can result in anaphylaxis, just like being stung by a wasp. But the name of that condition is called lepidopterism. Now, the next thing is Dr. Nieswater mentioned the event in Fairbanks. In Fairbanks in 2006, there was a significant increase in the number of hymenoptera, or stinging insects, in the Fairbanks area. It was estimated to be 10 times the normal level. There was a Dr. Jack Whitman, who is a biologist for Fish and Game, so he's got some credential, and using 3 homemade traps, which are basically like Mountain Dew bottles with some water and a hunk of herring or something in there, a whitefish, he trapped in just 3 traps, almost 3,500 yellow jackets just on his property alone. Then he went out and destroyed 9 aerial nests in 3 weeks, and he estimated killing 12,000 yellow jackets. So this was such a high outbreak of yellow jackets they canceled some of the sporting events and some of the other outdoor recreational events in that area. And what we found, or we thought, is that insects certainly adapt very well to warmer temperatures. And why did this happen? So we take a look. Well, again, what happened during that 2006, there were actually 2 deaths. Both of these individuals were stung But one of the individual actually received epinephrine, but it was not in time. The other one was an asthmatic and was actually using his albuterol inhaler when he crashed into the fence across the street from the hospital. And both of them were unable to be resuscitated in the emergency department. Both of them were, one of them was about 55 and the other was about 32 years old. And so these were the first two reported deaths in Alaska from Hymenoptera stings, and Dr. Brad Gessner and I reported that in the epidemiologic bulletin. So this raised two questions. Do these two deaths from insect stings during the summer of 2006 represent an increasing exposure to Hymenoptera in Alaska? Could there be a correlation between changes in climate and changes in Hymenoptera patterns in Alaska? So that was what we went in. Those are the questions we looked at. So what we did is we decided we would code. When you have a diagnosis code, if somebody has asthma, they have a code. If someone has, you know, a sprained ankle, they get a code. Well, if someone is stung by a yellow jacket or a bee, they get a code. So there's three basic codes. There are two emergency room codes. One of them is venomous insect specific to Hymenoptera. Another one is a bite or a sting from non-venomous arthropod. And then 989.5 is a toxic effect from venom. Well, since we don't have snakes and other reptiles, pretty much a venom is going to be a sting or a bite. And we looked at three different databases. I looked at Fairbanks Hospital from 1990 to 2006. I looked at our center. We're the only allergy, asthma, and immunology center in the state of Alaska. So we have, you know, if someone has a bad reaction to a sting and need to be desensitized, they're going to come to us. And then we looked at the state Medicaid database, which includes about 132,000 patients. So when we first look at Fairbanks, what we see is from about 1993, you see these are the number of cases of patients that are going to the emergency department because they were stung. So they're kind of averaging about 40. And then when you hit 2006, bam, look how this thing jumps. It jumps up to about 170 cases. So there was clearly an isolated, what we call an epiphenomena, or what's been termed as an outbreak year in Fairbanks. So does this? When you look at it, if you just look at the raw data, is there a trend? Yeah. If you take out that one point, the trend is not so impressive. So it does meet statistical significance, but this does seem to be a fairly isolated area. So we said, well, let's take a look at the rest of the state. So we looked at our clinic, and again, in 1999, we had four referrals for this reason, and that started climbing for every year thereafter until we reached about 24 in 2007. So when you do a trend analysis on this, this had a high degree of statistical significance with a p-value of less than 0.001. That means there's a 99.9% probability that this is a statistically significant event. So this is not guessing. This is not satellites. This is real. Then we looked at the Medicaid database. And again, this is 132,000 subjects. This is no little number. This is big. So when we took a look at theirs, and the blue line represents if their first diagnosis, second diagnosis, or third diagnosis was stung by an insect and had a bad reaction, then it fell into this blue line. The yellow and the pink line represent as a primary diagnosis is what that means. So if you either way, the curves are about identical. What we found, again, looking at a trend analysis, there was a very high degree of statistical power that shows there's definitely an increase throughout the state. And it's not something that's occurring just in 2006. This is something that has been occurring since the database was available, which is 1999. And again, we call it a chi-square for trend, having a statistical significant value of less than 0.001. So in other words, 99.9% probability that this is a real trend. It's not just an isolated event. So then our next question is why? When you look at the temperature in Alaska and how this has changed, how does it correlate with those changes that we're seeing throughout the state? So what we did is we broke out the state is, we didn't do it, this was already done. The state is broken into six epidemiologic regions. And so those regions, the northern region, interior, southwest, the Gulf Coast, southeast, and the Anchorage, Matsu region. So that's how this is broken out. So we used those regions, and what we did is we looked at the largest community in each of those regions, and we looked at temperatures, both winter temperatures and average temperatures over this period of time. And then what we did is calculate over this last 50 years, what has been the rise in those regions? So what we found, we looked at, again, those are the regions we looked at. So we looked at annual temperature and winter temperature, and you can see from Barrow, it's risen 3.8 degrees. Winter temperatures have risen 6.1 and all the way down the line. Like, all of them are over 3.4 or above for annual temperature rise. All are above 6.1 for winter temperature rise, with the exception of the Gulf or the Aleutian Islands, which Kodiak was the representative. That was only 1.5 degrees for both. Then we looked at sting incidents. And with sting incidents, we see that in Barrow region, the sting went from 16 to 119 per 100,000. In Southwest, and Bethel went from 62 to 113. From the Fairbanks, 33 to 509. South Central, 276 to 405. Juneau, 221 to 279. And the Gulf really did not change very much at all, 437 to 487. So what we did is, you know, so we're seeing something interesting now developing. And then we look at the statistical probability. And again, looking at trend analysis and statistical probability, we find that these are statistical changes throughout every one of these regions, with the exception of the Gulf region. So the Kodiak, which had the lowest change in annual and winter temperature, had the lowest change in the number of increase in stings, only had an 11% rise, which did not meet statistical power. What we also noticed is that Kodiak had the highest level of stings of all the regions prior to the study, which tells us that the warming trend probably occurred some years later, or maybe that because of the tidal winds or the coastal winds, maybe it's not as affected, or the temperature is a little more stable. But nonetheless, in five of the six regions, this was a significant result. So in summary, for Fairbanks Memorial, there was a fourfold rise, but it's important to note that seemed to be an epiphenomenon, or what we call an outbreak year. For the Allergy and Asthma and Immunology Center of Alaska, there was a threefold rise that did seem to meet, certainly met the statistical power or significance for trends. And when we looked at the Medicaid data, we also found that there was a significant rise through that period of time. And during that exact period of time, there was only a 6.4% rise in the population, so it certainly does not account for all the increase that we saw. So what we concluded is that it does appear that temperature was correlated with the significant rise in stinging and biting events occurring throughout Alaska. And through our research, it does when temperatures rise in Alaska, we tend to get more snow. You know, that's kind of counterintuitive to most people, but we know that. It doesn't snow very much when it's 10, but it snows a lot when it's 25. More snow, the snow has an insulating effect, and just in the way that it can protect trees is the same way that it can protect nests, what we call hibernaculum. Hibernaculum is where the queen winters over, and when the queen opens up in the spring and has survived the winter, then she's going out to make new nests. And we're gonna look at the data from 2006 through 2009 if we can get through this flu season and we can get a little more time on the computer. So the climate change has impact on life cycles. Mosquitoes and plant communities, I already mentioned, are migrating to higher ground as permafrost thaws and glaciers retreat. Beetle plague forests in Alaska, as well as beetle plague forests through the lower 48, are thought to be impacted by climate change and by warming temperatures. Lepidoptera, which is the stinging caterpillars, we're now seeing in the northern hemisphere. They're concerned about ticks. They're studying Oxides ticks in Sweden, and they've been studying the movement in northern migration in Sweden for the past decade. And what we're seeing is when you look at Sweden on the globe, it's really around the same latitude. In Canada, we're seeing issues with West Nile virus, only 1 degree south of Juneau. So there's concerns about that. So as we're seeing some of these vector-borne diseases, by the way, Oxides is one of the ticks that cause borreliosis or cause Lyme disease. So anyway, we're seeing these changes throughout the globe, and we've got to be aware that and be cognizant and survey for these issues in Alaska. So what impacted the Vikings? I'm going to go back to my initial graph from the IPCC, and I'll read it. Nothing actually stopped the Viking invasion until 892, when pestilence so ravaged the army that they finally dispersed. Kind of interesting what you learn in history. Now, of the failure of the Norse colony in Greenland, we cannot assume that other factors, including pestilence, did not play a more important part in their social collapse. So even when you go back in history, the pestilence and insects very well may be a marker of what's to come. They may be a bellwether. They may be that canary in the coal mine. I don't know. So what are our certainties? Climate change is occurring as the amount of greenhouse gases increase. This leads to global warming by trapping additional solar energy near the Earth's surface. We know that. Uncertainties include the estimation of health trends and the effects on subjects to many of there's so many variables. There's a lot of variables in there. It's not just a matter of there's more insects in Fairbanks. There's a lot of variables at stake and a lot of variables that have to be taken into account. That's why there's such wide variance between the predictions. And prior to anthropogenic means man-made climate change, there was little focus on climate-health relationship. And I think this is actually where a lot of the debate is. There's really two sides of a fence. One side of the fence says it's man, and the other side of the fence says it's not, it's nature. I'm standing in the middle of the fence saying it doesn't matter. It's here, and it's real, and it may be a natural cycle, but it's certainly a natural cycle that's the first time that we've seen it in our time, and it's something that we need to adapt to at minimum. The health risk of climate-related thermal stress, floods, and infectious disease lends itself to study, while other impacts attract less attention. That's things like disruption of fisheries, disruption of the ability for people to subsistence live, for loss of livelihoods, population displacement. How do you study those things? You observe. Well, one way to do that is actually Governor Palin, our ex-Governor Palin, initiated a sub-cabinet on climate change. This is through the DEC commissioner. There was four working groups within the sub-cabinet, the immediate action group, the mitigation advisory group, research needs working group, and the adaptation advisory group. And I was very proud to serve on the adaptation group. In that adaptation group, we looked at public infrastructure, health and culture, which is where I worked, natural systems and associated economies, and then other economic activities. So what the result of that was, this is it. Now, there's a mitigation, an immediate action, and a research and an adaptation. This is our report from our adaptation advisory group that is now at the governor's level being reviewed. So if anybody would like to use this as a paperweight, you can. But you might want to look at it. And actually, if you want to look, it's really quite interesting, and you might have areas that you're interested in. You can go to the DEC website, www.dec.state.ak.us, or you can go to DEC Alaska on the Google, and it'll take you here. And then you're going to click on Climate Change Alaska, and it's going to take you. You can see all the members of the subcabinet and these adaptation in these groups, and then you can download your own version of the adaptation recommendations. So again, do these observable changes in Alaska predict what's to come? Are Hymenoptera another indicator species or a bellwether of climate change? I don't know. I think the more data we can gather, the more information we can gather, I think the better decisions we can make. So I think that's important. We need to keep our eyes open. You know, this is one of my personal pet peeves. I think sometimes in the scientific community, especially in this country, we have to limit ourselves to acrylic boxes, and we oftentimes discount what we observe around us. Now, that's not true in other countries. In Europe, there's a lot of open-mindedness, and observations are a very important part of their science and their data. And quite honestly, their literature is a lot more interesting to read. But, you know, so we've got to be careful not to limit ourselves to an acrylic box, because you can't study the world in an acrylic box for a decade. It just isn't going to be very practical. So how are we affected today? Well, CO2 and climate change and health impacts is in our backyard. We see increases in pollen size and pollen amounts, both ragweed as well as tree pollens, as I've clearly demonstrated. We're seeing heat waves and smog, an increase of forest fire smoke, particulates, and pollens that's going to affect the upper and lower respiratory tract. We're seeing, I didn't even talk about mold, increased mold sporulation, but I'm actually on a task force looking at that right now, and we're seeing increased mold sporulation and mold issues, particularly cladosporium and alternaria correlated with some of these same variables. Believe it or not, poison ivy has become more virulent. There's several papers showing that under the influence of more heat and more CO2, poison ivy becomes nastier than it already is. We don't have any of that. We don't plan on getting any either. Then we're dealing, of course, with vector-borne diseases, whether it's a vector-borne disease from rodents, a vector-borne disease from insects such as ticks or mosquitoes. This is a concern, and it's a concern that is now becoming, you know, a concern as far north as Alaska. The West Nile virus, like I said, is only 1 degree south, and then Hymenoptera, the stinging insect that I've mentioned earlier with the fatalities in Fairbanks. And the increasing incidence of this throughout Alaska over the past decade. So when we look at climate change, it's not just a simple picture. Certainly, looking at climate change, the first thing is to look at the world, to look at your neighborhood, to look around. But unfortunately, when you take a little closer look, you realize that this is a very complex issue that involves the environment, public policy, and human health. So when you're looking at this, you can't just think unilaterally. You can't just think in a linear manner. You have to think planet, pathology, patient health, public health, and public policy. These all play together. And anytime a debate becomes a political debate, unfortunately, it loses ground and loses credibility. And I think it slows the process down significantly. But at the same time, I think debate needs to be out there, because when we debate, we usually come up with two directly opposing ideas. But when you discuss and you debate, it's amazing how central those two ideas can become. So I think working together and working with these ideas, not discounting any ideas. I don't discount any ideas. I think all of them are worth thinking about. All those ideas, all those concepts should be part of the discussion. They should be at the table. Because I think when we work together, we come up with a better answer. So are there research priorities? I think there are. That we want rapid research on climate change. I mean, I think that's important. And it's ongoing. There's a lot. I mean, if you go to Google and look, you're going to pull up millions of hits. But there's not a lot of research on the health impacts. I mean, that's probably measured in the hundreds, quite honestly. We would need to look at the decadal modes of variability. That decadal meaning decades. You can't look at years. You've got to look at decades. You've got to look at the big picture. You can't say what happened in 2007 and then equate that to everything else. You've got to look at what's happened over 20 years, over 30 years, to make any reasonable prediction. And what they're talking about here, like the North American Oscillation, as water warms, the planet tries to cool by these oscillating currents. And that's where we start seeing hurricanes and storms popping up. We want to have a better idea about methane release from the Arctic. We want to have a better idea of what's going on in the Arctic. Greenland ice melt, polar ice melt. Aerosol effects, the good news there is fluorocarbons are pretty much out of the existence right now. We're doing better with that. But there's still a lot of off-gassing that we have to be concerned with. Ocean acidification is occurring. Coral reefs are dying. I quite honestly, I'm not sure this is something we are going to be able to impact. I think that trend is already too far along. Regional and scale prediction, in other words, decadal. The point is, look at variables, look at decades, not years. Look at past climates, and that's been done with ice cores, for example. You can assess what's gone on for 100,000 years by measuring and looking at different changes in the ice over that period of time. And it's important to look at the Earth system science, which is the climate and ecosystem interactions. Now, is there mitigation? I think you have to mention this. I mean, my focus has been adaptation. Adaptation meaning it's here. Let's do what we can to adjust around it. Now, what can we do for the future? What can we do over the next 100 years? All the recommendations for mitigation really have to do with somehow trying to decrease emissions. Because what role are humans playing? If we're playing a role, it's certainly a role related to emissions. I think most scientists believe that we are. Again, that's probably an issue of debate. But the United States still remains the highest level of greenhouse gas emissions per capita in the world. So there's nothing more difficult to manage, more dubious to accomplish, nor more doubtful of success than to initiate a new order of things. Now, this is Machiavelli in 1513. So, the Arctic. Is this the window to our future? I'll let the audience be the decision. So with that, hopefully, I don't want to scare you. What I want to do is give you food for thought. I want you to think about it and start looking around and come up with your own ideas. You're the future that's sitting out in front of me, or most of you are the future. Some of us are the past. But, you know, hopefully you guys will do a better job than we did.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA. This week's program featured Dr. Jeff DeMaine speaking on climate change and the impact on human health, an Alaska perspective. The founder and director of the Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology Center of Alaska, Dr. DeMaine, was one of four premier Alaskan physicians selected to speak at the Alaska Whammy Mini Medical School public lecture series that took place at Providence Hospital in October. His talk on climate change and the impact on human health in Alaska perspective was recorded on October 20th, 2009, and edited for broadcast on KSKA. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.